Thank you, Jim. Thank you very much. A great pleasure to be here. Jeff and I were chatting out front. I don't know how much you're aware of how excessive the compensation is that you guys offer your keynote speakers. But in actual fact, I'm being very highly compensated. Not in a cash sense, because apparently Jeff doesn't have any. Apparently that's a common problem for university libraries everywhere. Is that a fair statement? Okay, it's not just you, Jeff. I'm pleased to hear it. Okay, but my compensation comes in two forms. Today it's only in one. You know how on your little programs, it says this afternoon you get to get on a bus and go to do a wine tour and have some fun? Well, I've got something even more fun for you guys to do. The Ticats are playing down in Iverwynn at 4 o'clock. Lots of really good seats going. And I guarantee that someone's going to win. The Ticats. That's an interesting one. How many of you guys are actually from Hamilton or this area? Okay, a complete aside to those of you from Hamilton. This team is actually much better than it was last year. You wouldn't know it on our record, but it's actually a much better team. And the mistake that caused the team to struggle over the last few years, interesting enough, all end up at my door. I can't even pretend to blame Greg Marshall or Dave Sauve for our previous years of ineptitude. And here's just an interesting story that I'll give, completely unrelated to what I'm going to talk about today. But the interesting story is I've spent my whole career in technology. And in technology, building technology companies, if you do sort of one of these little charts, on a matrix where the scale up and down is experience, the top has lots of experience, the bottom, little experience. And you go east-west on this thing, and on the one side you have, a reasonably, a bright guy, but on the right you have extremely high intelligence. Okay, in technology, you don't care about the up and down axis. You just don't care. Experience doesn't count for anything, because every 10 years, we do things completely differently. 10 years ago, it was all about personal computers. Today, you don't care about personal computers, you care about the internet. You use personal computers because you need a browser to access the internet, but you really could care less about what features or functionalities exist on your computer as long as it runs a browser reasonably well. And 10 years before that, it was all about mini computers, and 10 years before that, it was all about mainframes. And so every 10 years, you obsolete everything you know. So when I got involved with the Ticats, I went out and did what I always do to be successful. I went out and I hired the smartest guys I could. And the fact that they'd never been in these positions before didn't worry me at all, because I knew, based on my experience, that brains will always beat experience. So I had a head coach who had never been a head coach of a professional football team before. I had a general manager who had never been a general manager of a professional football team before. I had a president who had never been a president of a professional football team before. And we had this idiot owner who had never owned a professional football team before. And that was literally four too many rookies in the four critical positions. So today we now have an owner who, believe it or not, now has 5 years of experience. Maybe not very successful experience, but I know a hell of a lot more about running a professional football team than I did 5 years ago. We have a general manager, we have a president, Scott Mitchell, who is one of the most experienced sports marketing guys in the country. And we have Bob Obilovich, who is unquestionably the most successful general manager in the country. Of course, we're now in between finding our new head coach, but that's another story. The point is, with an experienced team in football, you play the game exactly the same way today than you played it 50 years ago. So suddenly, the intelligence axis doesn't matter. You can be a complete idiot as long as you actually know how to play the game really, really well. And that's been my 5-year learning curve. That's my graduating. of this degree in football team ownership. So for the Ticat fans out there, there is hope on the horizon. When we'll get there, I don't know, but I have a lot of confidence on that one. Anyway, so what I was going to talk to you about, on the other hand, is going back to what I do know, something about technology, because I came out of school in 76, so far ago that I don't remember these dates anymore. I went into the typewriter selling business. I ran a little typewriter rental company. Of course, you know, you'd go into your customers, your most loyal customers every year, and every year another customer who used to rent computers from you was no longer renting computers. So you'd put your sales hat on and you'd put on your best suit and you'd go in and visit him to try and convince him to come back. And you'd visit his, you know, whatever, 10,000 square foot office that used to have 50 people working with typewriters, and there wasn't a single typewriter on the floor. And you realized there wasn't much of a future. So we very quickly moved from typewriters into what at that time were computer terminal equipment. Some of you guys are old enough to remember LA36 and VT100 terminals that you plugged into your mini computer. You had an IT guy who lived in the back. So I got into personal computers or into mini computers in about 78, then got into personal computers, of course, in 82, and have spent the last, how many years is that? 28, 30? 30-odd years in technology. So I thought I'd talk about a little bit about open source, because I gather, and I can't tell you how much it encourages me, that you guys, one of the top topics here is open source. So I thought I'd, in about 5 minutes, explain everything I know about open source, because that's all I know about open source. There isn't that much to it. Then I thought I'd talk a little bit about Red Hat and how you make money or how businesses work in open source, but equally how what you guys are doing is fascinating to me, and it actually fits very neatly with what I understand drives the open source model. Talk a little bit about the internet, because as you guys know, the internet changes everything. And then talk about things like Lulu. And of course, I'd be happy to pitch Lulu at you guys all day, but there's actually a whole category of Lulu-like resources out there for you guys to use. And I'm going to do all of that in about 10 minutes so that then we can go to questions. And you can actually ask me what you really want to learn as opposed to what I end up pontificating to you about. Okay, so let's go back in time here. I was telling you I moved from the typewriter rental business into the computer equipment rental business, and that went really well. It's actually a really tough business, and we did all right at it until 1992. And in 92, we had that free trade-driven recession up here, but we also had a recession down in the States. And personal computers had shifted from the old 486s into the new Pentiums, and the value of personal computers were collapsing, and our business got into real trouble because we had to rent twice as many computers to generate the same amount of revenue, and it was hard to do. And I won't bore you with the business challenges of trying to use the same number of people to process twice as many orders. It was painful. Sufficiently painful that 6 months later, I found myself working out of my wife's sewing closet. Having taken my net worth from, you know, after college, I'd done really well. I built a couple of computer rental companies. At one point, I thought I was worth several million dollars. But by the time I got 93, I was working out of my wife's sewing closet. I had managed to take my net worth back down to below what it was when I graduated college 18 years earlier. Only this time, I had three young children, I had a big mortgage, and I had no income. Besides having no net worth, I had no income. What was interesting, however, is what we'd been doing in the computer rental business before I found myself in this situation was we'd been trying to move from the personal computer, where the values were collapsing, into Unix workstations. Sun Microsystems, Hewlett-Packard, IBM RS6000s, if you guys know these things. And it was all the Unix operating system. How many of you guys are truly technical? And I need a real show of hands. How many of you guys, for example, know the difference between Unix and VMS versus MVS? Seriously? About half, you think, roughly? Okay, so I'll try and give the short versions of some of the technical phenomenons. Unix was the predecessor to open source. And here's what happened to Unix. So it was really interesting. Unix is an operating system. The way to think of operating systems is they allow the parts in a computer to talk to each other. So the operating system is the thing that allows your hard drive to talk to the processor, allows the processor to talk to the memory to talk to the processor, obviously, but to talk to the applications, all of this stuff to be able to be displayed on a screen or a printer. That's the low-level stuff that operating systems do. As you know, Microsoft owns a monopoly of operating systems on the personal computer with their now Windows. What's Windows at? 2000? 3000? No, you're using a Mac. What's the latest Windows thing? Vista, that's right. Oh, the crappy thing that crashes all the time, right? Okay. By the way, for all that Microsoft may be a competitor of mine, it certainly was at Red Hat, and for all that they may do evil things, you have to be somewhat sympathetic to their challenges, because Microsoft's commitment to their customers is that they will never eliminate backwards compatibility. So Vista not only has to do everything that we want it to do on the internet looking forward, but it also has to support applications that were written for MS-DOS in 1980. And that's actually really, really difficult as a software project. And you end up being somewhat sympathetic to Microsoft's challenge of building good operating systems to do that. Of course, when I'm talking to open source guys about Microsoft and I start saying nice things to them, that this is actually a very well-run company with a huge number of very smart people, all my buddies at Red Hat used to look at me funny. I say, okay, guys, they may do evil things. Microsoft have been caught doing some very seriously anti-competitive things, and if you buy me a beer afterwards, I'll tell you some of the stories that haven't made the press that I'm aware of. They may do evil things, it's just that they do them so well. You have to admire these guys. Okay, so we're talking about Unix. The Unix operating system was written by a couple of guys at AT&T, Kernahan and Ritchie, in 1969. I shouldn't say a couple of guys because there were a lot of engineers at AT&T at the time, Bell Labs in New Jersey. So they had a big team to help them work on this, and their problem was they had been buying computers from a variety of suppliers. So they had Digital Equipment Company mini computers, and they had Perkin-Elmer mini computers. And if you know any of these names, you're as old as I am. Or at least you've wasted too much time in technology along with me. Perkin-Elmer mini computers, and of course all the old, there was IBM and the Seven Dwarves, all the Seven Dwarves, the Honeywells, the Sperry Univacs, all of these guys. And AT&T were spending huge amounts of money and time and effort trying to get these computers to talk to each other. And what Kernahan and Ritchie's project at AT&T was all about is, why don't we write a portable operating system, write our own operating system? And instead of buying computers with different operating systems and then trying to figure out how to make them work together, we'll throw away the operating system the computer comes with and we will run our Unix, Unified Operating System. That's where the name Unix comes from. And we're gonna, as a result, all these machines will work so much better together. AT&T, remember now at this time, was a regulated phone company. They were the regulated phone company in the States. So of course, they had more money than God because they were the phone company. And so they did a good job of it, but because they were a regulated phone company and yet this Unix project was a computer project, they didn't have any real proprietary interest in it. It was like open source. They just needed to use the software themselves. They didn't want to be beholden to IBM or Digital for their operating system. So they did it for the same reason people do open source today. They needed control over the technology they're using. So they gave it away. They didn't care if the universities used it for free or even if other commercial entities used it for free, as long as the people they gave it to contributed back their changes. starting to sound familiar. It's very much an open source model. And Unix did very well. In fact, it was growing very nicely sort of through those years, through the 70s into the early 80s. Except in 1982, an interesting phenomenon occurred, which was Judge Janine, I think was his name. Anyways, the guy who deregulated the American phone system. And he broke up AT&T into its component parts. That's where Southwest Bell comes from and Bell South and all the other pieces. What happened then was the guys who were running the old AT&T are going, hold on, we're no longer regulated. We no longer have a monopoly. We better figure out all the assets that we do have that we can make money on. So they did their inventory of all their assets and they go, aha, we own the copyright to Unix. All of these universities who have been using Unix for free need to send us money because we own the copyright. And that's exactly what they did. They started sending notices to all the people who thought Unix was a collective, was a shared project. They started sending them invoices. That's actually what triggered the open source movement, because what happened was a bunch of guys at MIT, Richard Stallman in particular, looked at this phenomenon and go, holy crap. You know, this was our really cool project. You know, we had source code, we all worked together on this stuff, and now AT&T just stole it. And if we're just going to replace it, because we have to do this, we have to get away from Unix, and we now have to build a better Unix than Unix, and we have to do it in an open source model, but someone's going to own the copyright. So how do we solve this problem? So what they did is they invented the GPL. Otherwise known as the general public license. And the GPL uses the copyright law to the benefit, because the problem with copyright law, actually with intellectual property law, is if no one claims ownership to something, technically you would think it would exist in the public domain. But it doesn't. It lives in a vacuum. So anyone who does claim ownership, who took a public domain piece of software that had no owner of it, and added even modest changes, could copyright the whole thing. So you have to copyright the software you're using, because there's no such thing as truly public domain intellectual property. There just isn't. It's an interesting legal concept. I'm not a lawyer. I can't do justice to it. But what the GPL does is use the copyright rules and say, okay, we're going to impose a copyright on this project, or we're going to invent a copyright that says not what you are not allowed to do with it, but what you are required to do with it. So the GPL simply says you are required to, you know, the Free Software Foundation owns a bunch of licenses for many of the open source projects, and the license basically says if you use this, you have every right to do whatever you want with it, you can make whatever changes to it you want, but if you give it to anyone, you cannot give it to them under any more restrictive a license than the license that you inherited when you first used it. And it's a viral-like license. What it means is everyone who uses this no longer has to check with the Free Software Foundation, because they read the license, they have the right to do whatever they want, and the Free Software license doesn't have to check with these guys because they know they've inherited under a license where they can't stop anyone they give the software to. In open source, just to be very clear, and this is a complete aside, one of the interesting things is you can play a semi-proprietary play here, which is if you don't give your software away to anyone, they can't use it if they don't have it. So there is a sense of, on the internet, you have a lot of open source projects where people are making additions to open source software that they are not giving away simply because they never distribute their code. eBay, as an example, runs a lot of open source software, makes a huge amount of modifications to their open source software, but you can't download the software for eBay and set up your own eBay site. They just don't make it available. And that's okay. That's perfectly within the realms of the license. Okay, so where were we? We're back at Unix. We got all the way up to the GPL. Okay, so Stallman, who wanted to do a better Unix than Unix, had a bunch of projects. One was called the Herd. Anyone heard of Herd, H-U-R-D? Whoa, we really do have some geeks in the audience. Okay, this is a real sort of schizophrenic audience here. between the guys who don't even know what the GPL is, all the way to guys who know what HERD is. Okay, so anyway, I won't get into it, other than there were a variety of projects to build an open source Unix. Turns out the problem with any Unix operating system, now let's go all the way back, the problem with any operating system is the kernel of the operating system. So as an example, Red Hat ships a operating system called Red Hat Linux, which is about a gigabyte big. It's made up of about 1,000 different packages. So the average package, the average piece of software in a piece of Red Hat Linux is, you know, whatever, a megabyte big. The Linux kernel itself is less than a megabyte, the Linux kernel. So of the gigabyte worth of source code that Red Hat will ship you if you download a copy of Red Hat Linux, the Linux kernel is less than 1/10 of the code. Actually, it's probably less than 1/20 of the code. I'm not familiar with the current percentages. So you sort of ask the question, why is it called Red Hat Linux? The answer to that one, like, why is it called Linux? Why isn't it called, I don't know, Red Hat or Unix or... And the answer is, the kernel is the rocket engine. It's like an airplane. You know, when you buy a Boeing jet and you pay, I don't know, how many of you guys have bought a Boeing jet recently? Okay. I haven't bought a Boeing jet recently. Anyway, there's roughly $50 million for a Boeing jet. Most of that money goes into everything but the engines, but without the engines, you don't have an airplane. So the engines of that $50 million are probably $10 million of that $50 million airplane, but they're the essential piece. Well, that's what the kernel is in an operating system. And Stallman built a whole bunch of necessary components to an operating system under this free software license, the X-Window system, as it goes on. I've forgotten more of these buzzwords than I remember. But what he could not get to work was the kernel. And so, just a complete aside, the reason the kernel is called Linux is because a fellow called Linus Torvalds, who was 18 at the time, and who was a hacker. So he did this when in 1992 is when he started, and so he was actually less than 18, I think, when he started. But anyways, he was about 18 by 92. He was an undergraduate at the University of Helsinki, and he posted a kernel to the internet because he saw all of this Unix code, and he goes, well, it needs a decent working kernel. And he posted a kernel to the internet that became an overnight sensation, despite the fact that Richard Stallman and his team at MIT had already spent a decade on the HERD kernel and still couldn't make it work. So it's just a wonderful story. The story was that Linus Torvalds, from when he was 8 years old, played with computers. His first computer was how many of you guys remember the Timex Sinclair? Whoa, right. These guys are seriously heavy duty geeks. We should run one of those Jeopardy things for serious geeks and see what you guys could really come up with. Anyway, but Linus's problem, this is back when there wasn't much software, so he liked the hardware side of it. So when, of course, the PC came out, he spent all of his time hacking at the PC and watching how BASIC would interact with processors, and he would build his own PCs. He gets to university, he starts learning about software, he starts learning about operating systems, and he suddenly goes, well, this HERD stuff is complete crap. And of course, the reason it was crap is it was written by guys who understood mini computers, not personal computers. And Linus had spent 10 years of his young life looking at personal computers. He discovers Unix, he goes, hey, this is easy. And it was one of those classic, whose quote is it, that genius is opportunity meeting the prepared mind? Linus Torvalds stumbling into Unix in 1992 was opportunity, both because he had spent 10 years looking at the personal computer and then he learns operating systems, but he also arrives at the time the internet arrives. So the beauty of Linus's position was that he was in Helsinki, Finland. He was not in Stanford, California, at Stanford University. He was not even in New Jersey or Boston, or even Hamilton. he was in Helsinki, Finland. And you actually talk to Linus at this to this day, and you ask him how many of the other students or engineers in Finland or in Helsinki or at the university who helped him with it. His answer is, are there any engineers in Finland? Of course, he's being facetious. Finland runs Nokia, among other sort of brilliant engineering companies. The point was, being in Finland, he had no one within driving distance to compare notes to. So how did he get his advice? Where did he go to for intelligence, for expertise? And he had to go to the internet. And the problem that a lot of the projects, the one at MIT, the HERD project, was having, is most of they had four or five engineers who would get together in Boston and compare notes. But then when they would put it out on the internet and everyone on the internet would send them suggestions, the five or six of them would get together and go, is that a good suggestion? And whoever on the little team was in charge of that area would see it as a threat and say, oh no, that's not nearly as good as the work I'm doing. So their little team, as human beings tend to do, was suspicious of the input they were getting from the outside world. Linus Torvalds had no choice. He had to listen to the advice he is getting from the outside world, and he had to rate all of that advice. He had to look at it, he had to go, well, now is this guy smarter than that guy? You know, I'll try the various patches, I get three patches for the same bug, which patch works better? So he was able to build a team on a pure meritocracy. And when I say pure meritocracy, if you look at the Linux kernel engineering team, there's about 10 or 12 senior guys on that team. They are evenly distributed around the world in countries that speak enough English. So you don't have a lot of them in China, mainly because of you know, kind of all the censorship, freedom of speech issues in China. But literally, you have Ingo Molnar out of Budapest. You have Stephen Tweedy out of Edinburgh. You have Alan Cox out of Cardiff, Wales. You had David Miller out of Montclair, New Jersey. He's now in California. You had Ted So, who was in California. And it was that kind of distribution of these engineers around the world, because he didn't care where you were. You weren't within driving distance. You know, he didn't prefer your idea because you bought a beer. Sorry, it's a reference to free as in beer. He listened to you because your idea actually worked better than someone else's idea. And that's why he was able to build a kernel that worked, where the guys at MIT had spent 10 years and never actually delivered a working kernel. Okay, so fast forward, we're at now 92, 93. Linux is starting to go. I'm sitting in my wife's sewing closet going, oh crap, now what do I do? You know, without any money to put my kids through college, the only thing I knew how to do was to rent computers, and I'd concluded that that was a really bad business. But going all the way back to being a typewriter salesman, what I was listening to was all of these engineers. When we were trying to sell Unix workstations, I got to meet all the Unix engineers who were using these workstations, and they were all telling me about free software and Linux and the X Window system, and I was saying, well, who's making this stuff? I mean, if it's free, you know, who gets paid for building it? And they'd use lines like, well, it's from engineers according to their skill to engineers according to their need. I'm going, damn, that sounds awfully familiar. And then I go, yeah, that's right. The Berlin Wall just fell a couple of years ago. That's Karl Marx. And it is. From workers according to their skills to workers according to their needs, was how Karl Marx was dividing up the production of society. And that's how the software engineers who were building these open source tools thought of what they were doing. They thought it was altruism. So when I first looked at this, I thought, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. You know, there's not a chance is this going to go anywhere. It's sort of a fluky thing because the little internet's new and everyone likes each other, but they won't like each other soon enough, so it'll go away. But every time I looked at it, so in 92 and then in 93, it kept getting bigger. The software got better, there were more users. And then 93 to 94, there were even more users. The software kept getting bigger. And I go, that doesn't work. Now, and I'm a good free market capitalist, and I know, without a doubt, that human behavior does not replicate itself unless there's an economic model that can sustain it. It just doesn't. Take my word for it. I'm a good capitalist. If you're not a good capitalist, buy me beer. And we can debate it. Okay, anyway, so as a good capitalist, I'm just a huge skeptic of this thing. But it kept getting stronger. It kept getting more complete and better. So I actually went around, and I was now unemployed, working out of my wife's sewing closet. So I was starting to sell Unix tools to the same people that when I was in the computer rental business, I had tried to get to rent computers. And I had a little newsletter that I was trying to run out of Nancy's sewing closet. So I was looking at Unix, and I went and visited some of the customers who were, and some of the engineers who were both contributing to the Unix code and who were buying Unix from me. And I would sit down and I'd ask them where it came from, and I'd get all this recitation, it's all altruism, and then I'd talk to their boss. So in particular, there was a good story, you guys will like this one. I was at the Washington, D.C. Unix Users Group, 1994, meeting with Don Becker, who was a member of this user group, and I gave a little talk a little bit like this about what I'd been learning about Unix, and you know, after the session, Don comes up to me and says, Bob, you'd really be interested in what we're using Linux for at Goddard Space Flight Laboratory, which is a big NASA lab outside of Washington. And I go, well, what are you doing? He says, well, we're building supercomputers out of personal computers, off-the-shelf personal computers, and we're running, you know, Linux on it. I go, wow, that does sound fascinating. So we hop in his car and we drive over. And as we're pulling up to the gate, the penny drops and Don goes, Bob, you aren't Canadian, are you? Knowing full well I was Canadian. He goes, I don't think you're allowed into one of America's most secret research labs. But fortunately, Don and his boss got along really well, and his boss apparently was well-connected. So Don calls his boss on his cell phone. His boss wakes someone up at Goddard Space Flight Laboratory who gets me clearance and calls the security gate and says, well, if he's got his passport, we'll let him in, as long as he leaves within 15 minutes or something. So they get me a pass, and I'm whisked in. I'm feeling very important because I'm now allowed into Goddard Space Flight Laboratory. And I go into Don's little lab. And there he had, we don't have these anymore because we all use laptops, but the little sort of towers that you had beside your desk. And they had 16 of them stacked four up and four across, wrapped with duct tape to hold them together. And out the back of each of these was an Ethernet card, was an Ethernet cord connected to a router back into the next one. And they were literally building parallel processing supercomputers out of a duct-taped stack of off-the-shelf personal computers, and they are running Linux on it. And I'm going, Don, who's paying for this stuff? You know, because this isn't altruism. You know, the guys who build these computers aren't giving them to you for free. And you've clearly, and Goddard has clearly spent money and your time doing this. Who's paying for this? Oh, you know, the guys who need the weather modeling that we're trying to use this computer to do are paying for it. I said, well, is he around? He said, well, actually, the guy I called when we were at the gate is working late. That's my boss, Thomas Sterling. I said, well, can I chat to him? Sterling apparently had knew enough about Linux that he thinks this is cool. A guy who actually sells Linux has shown up at Goddard, so he wanted to find out if his interest was, does this Linux stuff have a future? So my interest was, why the hell is Goddard investing so much in it? And sorry, I didn't explain. Don Becker wrote all the early Ethernet drivers for Linux, literally all of them. And Ethernet drivers are kind of like Linux kernels. They are very low-level technology, sophisticated stuff. So I'm chatting with Dr. Thomas Sterling, who actually has budget dollars at Goddard Space Flight Laboratory. And I say, Don says that you are contributing to Linux out of altruism. How do you see the investment that Goddard is clearly making in what Don's doing? How do you justify it? And we're sort of shipping Linux at the time, so I was saying, and how do you rationalize your Goddard's altruism with my little company's commercial gain? Because when Don uploads his Ethernet drivers, I get to put them on a CD and sell them back to you. So I make money, and you give things away. How does, you know, what do you make sense? Yeah, how does that work? And Thomas Sterling was one of the guys in the early stage of this who articulated the economic model that actually does underpin this open source thing. And it was that he says, okay, Bob, let me get this straight. Don actually does a lot of work. He's a really smart guy, and he does a lot of work, and he builds really sophisticated Ethernet drivers. And you're probably right. If we put up them under a commercial patent and we hired a sales guy, we probably could sell Don's Ethernet drivers to a variety of different computer companies for roughly $25,000 per computer company, or some royalty basis where they pay us a couple of dollars for every computer they ship. Either way, it's a lot of money. But make sure that I understand this one properly. I'm giving you, for free, no obligations at all, complete source code and a license to do whatever you want with it, $25,000 worth of our code. And all that you are giving back to me, it's trivial, not very much, all you're giving back to me is a gigabyte of operating system, multi-user, multitasking operating system, which I get complete source code for and a license to put it on as many computers as I can put my hands on. And you're trying to tell me you're taking advantage of me? And with that story, it's a classic description of a barter arrangement. So just sitting outside chatting with Jeff before, and we were talking about some of your guys' use of open source, and Jeff was saying that he just hired, is it John? John. Just hired John as his full-time technical engineer to contribute to the open source projects that they are working on. And that's exactly how open source works, because you don't have to have that many Jeffs around the world hiring a few Johns, and suddenly you've got more engineers working on library software than the biggest commercial library software company can afford to hire. As another example, this conversation with Dr. Thomas Sterling led directly to the formation of Red Hat. And Red Hat then, literally within 36 months, started winning InfoWorld, the big computer magazine, Product of the Year Award in Server Operating System. Okay, so this is at a point where Red Hat had 50 employees in the tobacco fields of North Carolina. And we won the Product of the Year Award up against Microsoft, Sun Microsystems, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, a couple of other multi-billion dollar technology companies to whom server operating systems were strategically important to the success of their business. And somehow the 50 guys at Red Hat, not all of us being engineers, some of us being typewriter sales guys, we were winning the award for building a better operating system that they could build. And so, of course, the press loved this. They wrote it up as David versus Goliath, except for the fact they got it backwards. We were Goliath. Microsoft was David. Because Microsoft could afford several thousand high-paid, top-flight engineers to work on Windows NT at the time. We had tens of thousands of engineers working with us on Red Hat Linux. We had a bigger engineering team than even the biggest technology companies could work. So what Jeff and David are doing is exactly the same model in library science open source projects. That the software companies that you guys are a little frustrated with and who are feeling a little intimidated, by the way, just in case they haven't mentioned this to you, with you guys going this open source route, you guys with very little effort on each individual one of your institution's parts will end up with a bigger engineering team than the biggest engineering team of the biggest library science software maker without too much distance. Of course, then you get into all of the issues of how do you educate John Fink, is it? The John Finks of this world into how to build open source software, because you don't build it the way you build commercial software. Commercial software, all your engineers sit in a building, they all get to talk to each other, they all have the same source code management tools, they all go to the same training course, they have the same boss, they work 9 to 5, you know when they show up, you can check in their code. There's a process to it. In open source, it's a collaborative process. Now, John might like to code in C++, and the other guys on the team might much prefer Ruby on Rails. I don't know. I'm not a coder. For all I know, Ruby on Rails uses C++. The point being that there's a knowledge issue here that you have to get the team over. If you're hiring the right guys, they've educated themselves because they've been playing with open source for 10 years now, and so they know a lot of this stuff, which is why John's looking at his laptop instead of listening to me.
He's talking about you on the IRC channel.
Oh, great. And he's telling all my colleagues at Red Hat, who is this moron? We thought he was smart before he opened his mouth. Okay, so that's what this open source thing, and that's why what you guys are doing makes huge amount of sense. And it personally very, and I was only, I wasn't actually kidding when I was saying it was personally encouraging to see this open source movement continue to gain momentum through more and more vertical applications. You know, if libraries are using open source techniques to build technology, golly, virtually anyone can do it. Okay, last couple of things for you guys to think about, and then I'll take some questions. The internet changes everything, as you guys know this, but a lot of us don't stop that often to realize how big a difference the internet has made in our lives and in our society and in our economy. Morgan Stanley, at the start of this year, wrote an economic forecast. Turns out to be an incredibly insightful economic forecast because they were very pessimistic on the health of the economy this year. But the title of their economic forecast was nothing but net, meaning there wasn't a single industry in the United States that was going to do well this year except for the internet-related industries. Turns out, of course, the economy is this credit freeze in the States. I won't get into it, but if you're watching it sort of casually going, oh, that's interesting, it's a lot more than interesting. The economy in the States has literally fallen off a cliff. Even technology companies like Lulu, we are 25% below our revenue forecast this quarter. It's just astounding. And everyone else is as well. When we first saw this, we go, oh crap, we've screwed up. You know, our servers mustn't be responding. You know, we must be doing something really stupid. Until we started comparing notes, and everyone from Amazon to eBay are seeing exactly the same phenomenon. Actually, eBay is seeing less of it, and Lulu may see less of it over time. Because the nice thing about eBay is the more unemployment goes up, the more people have an incentive to open a store on eBay and try and make some money. So it's actually a market that works well when times are tough, because it's a very efficient market. But what's interesting for you guys, and this is where you guys in your fields know so much more than I do, and I'm not going to waste my time speculating on what the internet services are that you should be paying attention to. Because I tried that, actually. I was down in San Antonio a few months ago speaking to a very similar group. It was the university technology conference. So it was all the people who ran the networks and the resources that the universities lived on. And I came up with a brilliant idea. I said, you should look at, I can't remember what I told them to look at. I was almost booed off the stage because they were all looking at suppliers, you know, sort of a further generation ahead of the guys I was telling them to look at. So I'm not going to go into the specifics other than just to talk a little bit about what Lulu's doing. Because it's a big trend, which is that you develop services that you deliver over the internet. This is my point about in 1995, I'll give you a little more history just to bore you guys and impress the guys with long hair around here who are old, gray hair, I should have said. No hair like you and me. There's a reason I always wear a hat. In 1995, Larry Ellison of Oracle Corporation and Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems were so tired of being pushed around by Microsoft that they went public with this big initiative to build the network computer. And what they were going to propose was a very lightweight computer that didn't do anything. It would be a laptop that only ran a browser, and all of the resources would be on the internet, and you would no longer need a Microsoft operating system. And they thought, well, this would be cool. Only problem is they were literally a decade and a half ahead of their time because there were no applications for this network computer. the internet wasn't the internet today. What's fascinating is how sophisticated the solutions available on the internet today are. And so you now actually can, if you tried, you could use a computer and not save anything to your computer. You could use either Apple Mail and all of Apple utilities, or just go and use Google's or use Yahoo's, keep all your mail on Yahoo's servers, store all your files on Yahoo's, use the word processing applications on Google, actually on Google, in your browser, so you're not actually typing on your computer. It looks like you're typing on your computer. You're actually typing on Google's server, and you keep all your files out there on Google. And if you can do this personally, think what people like SAS and SAP and Oracle are doing for commercial enterprises in the same way. So we are pushing more and more of our computing away from the machine sitting in front of us and back out onto the server. So the machine sitting in front of us is, in fact, Scott McNeely and Larry Ellison's network computer. So they were right. They were only, 13 years ahead of their time. So these are the trends you want to pay attention to. And anytime, your organization says, oh, we need to come up with another $500,000 worth of internal networking and servers and hardware and IT guys running around to look after all of this stuff, you guys have to spend a lot of time saying, well, hold on, could we outsource all of this? Could we push this out to the net where we don't have to have our own IT guys? Because much as you like IT guys, and in fact, I love IT guys, if only I was smarter, I too would be an IT guy. The fact is they cost money, and they cost money not just in their salaries, but in all of the work that they do, because all that work needs to be done. I'm not blaming this on them. They try and solve these problems. But the moment you run your own computer, you have all of the challenges of upgrading that computer ever into the future, dealing with new releases of operating systems from evil companies like Red Hat, who constantly upgrade Red Hat Linux, and so you need a smart guy, unless, of course, companies like Red Hat are now pushing even their operating system services out to the net. So now you can install Red Hat and not have a sysadmin because Red Hat will manage your computer for you. That's what's interesting. So for example, on Lulu, you can publish your book on Lulu for free. And when your mother comes to buy your book, because we all have at least one customer for our book, on a single book, on just one, your mother will get a reasonably priced book, you will make money, and Lulu will make money on the first book that you sell. So suddenly, the whole publishing industry, this idea that you send your manuscript in and you go back and forth with the publishing team's editorial department for 6 weeks, and then eventually they send you a proof and you finally go, oh, okay, well, that's good enough, everyone's names are spelt properly. And so you go, okay, and you sign off on it, and then they print 10,000 and they put them in a warehouse somewhere, and then they ship 5,000 of them out to 5,000 different bookstores. And if you're lucky, some number of those will sell, and if you're not lucky, all 5,000 will get returned to the publisher. Sorry, I've lived this story. I actually published a book, as a complete aside. When we were doing Red Hat, I published a thing called Under the Radar. It was a story of where Red Hat had gotten to. I won't get into the long story of it, other than to say that Under the Radar was a really, really bad book. But it served its purpose, and it sold a whole bunch of copies. And they paid me an advance of about $2,000, well, to be precise, $2,311.68 as an advance on these books. And so the story was, 6 months later, I call them up saying, well, how many of you sold? They've sold 20,000 copies of them, because Red Hat was, of course, a darling of the stock market, and it was reasonably popular. And they were selling them at $25 a copy. So in effect, 20,000 copies at $25 a copy, someone had made $500,000 off of my book, and I'd earned $2,311. If you're wondering if I'm a little bitter about this experience. So I called up the publisher, and I said, so where'd the $500,000 go? Because I haven't seen it. And the publisher walked me through the economics of publishing. He explained about having to put in his case, 30,000 copies in a warehouse, that he might have sold 20,000 copies, but he still got 10,000 copies in a warehouse. And that, for that matter, of the 20,000 copies he sold, he counts them as sold when he sends them to the bookstore, but the bookstore has 6 months' right to send the book back to him. And that all of his marketing that he does is all deductible against my royalties, and all the negotiations he does with foreign translations he deducts against my royalties. And by the time he gets through explaining the economics of publishing, I'm going, so can I send you some of this money back? Publishing is a really hard way to make a living. And the way it works is the publishing companies make all their money off of Harry Potter or John Grisham. And they use the money they get from their bestsellers to subsidize all their other titles that they hope will become bestsellers. So I was very proud of selling 20,000 copies of a book about a computer company. My publisher was disappointed. He was hoping I would sell 50,000 copies because at 50,000 he might actually make money. At Lulu, you can make money on a single copy of your book. You can sell your book, and I'm talking a physical copy of the book. You can also sell your book electronically on Lulu, which is why we pay attention to things like the Kindle, the Amazon Kindle book reader. Piece of data for you guys. I don't know if you saw this last week. Apple put out a story about how the Apple is, in fact, the world's most popular book reader, because there's a new book reading application available, and it's been downloaded 350,000 times in the last couple of weeks. So people are reading books on their Apple iPhone as opposed to reading them on Kindles. The other point is, of course, Apple builds brilliant user interfaces, and the Kindle is a really crappy user interface if you've tried it. I've tried it. My wife actually had learned to use it, and she uses it really well. So that's pretty much all the insights I have. You're done. The tickets for Iverwin are available starting immediately. And we got 10 or 15 minutes for a few questions, if you have anything that you actually want to know about. Sure.
Two questions for you. The first one is, what kind of beer do you like? The second one is, because we're all library technologists here, I was wondering if maybe you might be able to just briefly talk about how you think libraries could work and partner with Lulu to do on-demand printing and things like that.
Well, I'm going to duck that with the Lulu one to Jeff, who's doing brilliant things with Lulu. So you can do all of your less popular titles on Lulu. Lulu is a long tail play. In the book, The Long Tail, Lulu actually has a couple of pages because the author was fascinated by us because we are all tail. The concept of the long tail is that the bestsellers today sort of mostly go away, but they continue to sell for the next few decades. And if you add up the total sales of all of today's bestsellers, they actually sell fewer dollars than the cumulative sales of all the bestsellers going back to the history of time selling a small number. So the story they use is Netflix, it's something like 70% of Netflix revenue comes from films that are not in their 10,000 most popular films. 10,000 most popular films. The 10,000 most popular films on Netflix is virtually every film that us put together could think of. So what's the 10,001st most popular film? It's probably Albanian. Because none of us watch Albanian films. But you know that there's a market for Albanian films. How many people live in Albania? What, 4 million of them? So there are people who watch Albanian films. And you put all the Albanians together, and I don't mean Albanians. I'm including the guys who live in Luxembourg, the Finns, the guys who live in Thailand, all these guys who speak weird languages that I don't understand. The scary bit is there's a lot more of them than there is of us. And then there's all the specialty guys. You know, the guys who watch films on pimping out your car or your computer or, you know, whatever. And so we all have some specialty. And if you add all those specialty items. Okay, so that's what the long tail is the popular stuff becomes less popular, but the total sales of that less popular stuff is still hugely popular. And historically, that stuff was simply not available. You couldn't buy a Farmer's Almanac of 1930 today. Why bother? Well, someone might want to read the Farmer's Almanac from 1930. Well, the internet allows, has no cost of inventory. Why wouldn't you leave the Farmer's, why wouldn't Farmer's Almanac have, had the internet been available in 1930, the 1930 Farmer's Almanac would still be available and would still occasionally sell, is my theory. So what the interesting bit about Lulu was, though, is we never have bestsellers. You know, the again, this concept of the publishing industry, that the bulk of their money come from, you know, the top 5% of their authors. In Lulu's case, virtually none of our money comes from our top 5 selling authors. Our money comes across, and by the way, the number was, it's not 100,000 titles, we have 705,000 titles on Lulu. We have 500,000 authors of those titles. Our bestseller is a guy in Singapore, who, a fellow called Mr. Go, who has sold, sold $150,000 worth of books, but he sells them at a very high markup. He's literally made $100,000 in the last 18 months selling technical books. Zencart, how to use Zencart is his area of specialty. Zencart being an online, an open source shopping cart tool that you can download and run in your library to make sell t-shirts, make a little bit extra money. He's our bestseller. He would barely qualify. He sold 150,000 books and he's made $100,000. I sold 500,000 books and I only made $2,311.63. And no, I'm not bitter at all. Other questions? Or was there another part to that question that I ignored? Okay, yeah, we're gonna take that one offline. The beauty of Lulu is it's out there. You got your laptop open on the, you know, just swing it around and figure it out for yourself. I'm actually only being partially facetious on the figure it out for yourself bit, because when you offer a service for free, your ability to offer customer service is very limited. Sorry, behind you. Okay.
One was every library publisher that is currently alive had pissed me off. mostly because of your story, you know, you sell 500,000 copies and you get $2,000, that kind of thing. The other was that I wanted to offer the book for free as a download and then put the hardback out there so that libraries and whoever wanted the hardback, best cover version, could buy it. And you probably never find a publisher would ever allow that.
Thank you for that. I love audiences that do a better job answering my questions than I do, so thank you. Sorry, other question? Was there one over here? No? Okay, other questions, anyway.
What kind of beer do you like?
Oh, the good point. Actually, I have an answer to that. And it's a two-part answer, but it's both the same beer. I like Molson Canadian because Molson sponsors the Tiger Cats. That's one half of the answer. The other half of the answer is, do you remember the Molson ad that they used the Irish folk song, folk guys of I will walk 100 miles or 500 miles? Sorry? They were Scottish, were they? Okay, so the Scottish guys, I will walk 500 miles. And it was the theme song to a thing of a Canadian living down in the States having to walk 500 miles across the border to get to the LCBO to buy Molson Canadian to walk 500 miles home to open it with his buddies. I can't tell you how that, you know, that commercial played kind of reasonably well in Canada. It was the biggest hit with every single Canadian living in the States. We all became Molson Canadian drinkers because we all have something for which we would walk 500 miles to get home to eat. So, you know, some of us it's maple syrup, others it's in my daughter's case, she'll love this, it's poutine. Sure, go ahead.
Now, you said you're not a coder. You referred to yourself as a typewriter salesman several times, and yet you've made a lot of money in technology.
Yep.
So what advice do you give someone like me who, like, I'm not the best coder in the world, I can sort of hack around PHP code and stuff like that, but I have a lot of good ideas that I would need help on. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah. Find yourself a friend who is a good coder. Rule number one. The other one is don't even start. It sounds like you qualify, by the way, here. Don't even start unless you really, really like technology. So my little joke about I would be a coder if only I was smart enough actually has a real element of truth. I think of myself to our engineers at Red Hat Now at Lulu. I am to the engineers what a groupie is to a rock band. What's the point of being a rock band if you don't have groupies? Groupies are necessary to have rock bands. Okay, what's the point of coding if you don't have typewriter salesmen who can convince people to use your code? So I'm a huge, I actually have always enjoyed the technology. I used to read Scientific American in high school. It never inspired me to take I did take a programming course at college, but it never inspired me to actually get my fingers dirty getting inside of televisions or anything. But I love the concepts behind technology. And so in that sense, I can debate issues. I can debate architectural themes with coders. I just don't have the patience to actually figure out how to code and make things work. So I find smart guys who can do that, and I make them my best friends. And the only comment I'd warn you about is it's not all about you. It's about the collaboration. So if you try and get the coders to implement your ideas, you won't get nearly as good a solution as if it's our idea that gets coded as opposed to any one person's idea.
Because that's a common theme. Like I've been reading up on several self-help books like the last year, self-help books from like successful people, right?
Yep. And the other thing, though, you need is you need a real passion for what you're doing. Because it's going to be stupidly difficult. In fact, it's going to be virtually impossible. So if it's impossible, why do it? Well, the only reason to do it if it's impossible is because you really, really, really like doing it. And you're going to do it anyway, despite it being impossible. And if you really, really like doing it, then who knows what magic, comes out of that process. But don't do it because you think you can make money at it or because someone tells you to do it, because way too much work and life's too short. Any other questions? I think we're running low on time here. There must be another question. Golly, you guys actually are librarians. Sure, at the back.
Since no one has an actual relevant question, I'll ask my irrelevant question.
Sure. Yes.
Where do I find such a thing?
We actually have a little store just along King Street, just south of King Street. The street is called Jarvis. But if you go along King Street to Denninger's and go north from Denninger's towards the bay, downhill, you'll get to our little store. I believe it's open up until about an hour before game time. Or go over to Ivor Wynn, and of course we'll sell you lots of stuff, but Ivor Wynn doesn't opens an hour and a half before game time, so it'll be open at 2:30, because the game's at 4 o'clock today, so you can go to Ivor Wynn. And if you go to Ivor Wynn, you also get to take in a Ticat game. So how much better? Okie doke. Well, with that, thank you very much for listening to me today. Thank you. Thank you.
We're almost done. I'm just here to say goodbye, to thank everyone for coming, to all the volunteers, conveners, and especially the speakers. I think they did a great job and should have another round of applause for all their stimulating presentations. Next year for Access 2009, don't go to Abilene. It's in Prince Edward Island, and I highly recommend it. Grant didn't pay me to say that, but PEI, as everyone knows, is one of the beauty spots of the world, and it's known for lobster, beaches, Anne of Green Gables, and of course, Mark Leggett. Where is Grant? He's going to tell you more about next year's conference. Thank you.
It's almost beer time. Thank you for Access 2008. It's been excellent. We had a nice meeting last night to help us plan for next year. And in typical collaborative fashion or groupthink fashion, if anybody's Googled Road to Abilene yet, we're going to contact all of you to figure out how to do Access 2009. But not do the paradox thing. We're going to fork it. Nobody gets that. Okay, I've got three T-shirts. If anybody's been knows UPEI and Mark and our VRE project, I've got three T-shirts that I'd like to give out. I'm going to do a couple of trivia questions. I'll do them in order of small, medium, large and two mediums. So, what's the smallest province in Canada? Oh, were you first? Who was first? Very good. I didn't say they were going to be hard. This is a shirt we had made up. It's just got UPEI on the front. And on the back, we have weekly meetings for our virtual research environment. And one of our metadata librarians, Louise Mold, is an artist. And she doodles during the meetings. So this is, on the back of the shirt, is Louise's doodle for, I'm not sure whether this is the first meeting or, it's an early meeting anyway, November 22nd, VRE 2007. So I'm going to lead you a little bit into the motto to see if you can see if we can all figure it out together. The Road to Abilene, fork it. What's the sequel to Anne of Green Gables? Anne of Avonlea is the correct sequel. But yes, there was a TV show, which is what I was fishing for, called Road to Avonlea. But who said the Anne of Avonlea? Excellent. So the Road to Avonlea is kind of like the Road to Abilene. And does anybody know what the Abilene paradox is?
Thank you.
Yes. Right, okay, so I won't belabor too much. So what's the other description? What's the other description for the phrase Road to Abilene? Another word that describes what that's describing. One more. Oysters. There's lots of oysters. When you come to PEI next year, there's an oyster bar that has a list of different kinds of oysters that are described in the same fashion as wine would be in a lovely restaurant. It's pretty cool, just reading it. I'm searching for a This is what my 6-year-old does when she's trying to give me a hint. Para. Oh, God. Potato. Yes, very good. whoever said paradox first, come on up and get your shirt. Thank you very much for Access 2008, and we look forward to seeing everybody at Access 2009 in Charlottetown.
While they're catching the front of the table, I just wanted to remind those of you who are staying on for the Canadiana.org Alouette Canada Tech meeting that's starting immediately after this. We're just heading across to Hamilton Public Library. Directions are really easy. You go down through the lobby downstairs. Don't go out the doors here. They're alarmed. So you go downstairs through Kitty Corner, through the mall underneath to Hamilton Public Library. Go to the fifth floor, the boardroom. We'll be starting the meeting as soon as we all get there. So see you there in 5 minutes or so. And I'd like to thank also the organizers for doing a great job. Thanks for a great conference, you guys.